Welcome to another series of UBC Arts on the Air, a set of interviews and profiles with leading members of the Faculty of Arts. And I'm Ira Nadell. Today, my guest is Dina Alkasem, a member of the Department of English, whose interests range over such areas as psychoanalysis, post-colonialism, and gender theory. Welcome. How are you?
Thank you, Ira.
Great. I want to begin, Dina, with a very broad general question, and that is simply, how would you describe your areas of interest, and did they evolve from study or travel or personal background?
I think all of the above. I came to the topic of ranting, which is the subject of my first book, largely because I was located in Berkeley in the late 90s when everyone had a zine. And everyone was involved in politics, and everyone was involved in theory. So it was quite a heady time. And my background naturally predisposes me to be interested in cultural exchange and cultural translation globally, because I grew up in the Middle East. I traveled to Europe regularly. I was often in the U.S. And in my own family life and school, certainly, I was always in the midst of many languages and many cultures. So to be in that Berkeley setting and to be to have license to engage in utopian thinking, but also very stern critique, I think led me naturally to the kinds of interests that I have. When I say that I was interested in politics, I certainly was, but in the 90s, political theory had this idea that we could really reinvent ourselves, our social relations, our communities, and so on. A bit idealist, but I think from the vantage point of postcolonial studies in history and psychoanalytic theory, I was a little bit more grounded than some people.
But where does one go to do a dissertation in ranting? What I really mean is, what department would, sponsor, encourage, direct?
Allow.
Yes, allow. Thanks. That's the verb.
The Comparative Literature Department at Berkeley. And the generosity and guidance of my mentors there, Judith Butler, Michael Lucy, Celeste Langan, John Bishop. These are all thinkers who, in their own work, have really pressed the boundaries of known scholarship and produced really original ideas in their work. So they let me do what I wanted. I mean, for instance, I was so terrified of writing my perspectives that my only way to do it was to make it into a kind of performance or even a parody. I wrote it as a middle school science project. And they loved it. So, it had sections, materials, apparatus, outcome. And I think the prospectus had something like 12 chapters. So there was a little restraint or restraining of my impulses. But basically, Berkeley was a context in which scholars who had committed themselves to really, I think, original projects wanted to foster that in their students.
So let's refine this a little bit. How do you define ranting?
Well,
and how do you define it in the book?
Yes. There's a long introduction. But I would define ranting as a genreless speech act. So there is no pattern or genre. That is a kind of rebuke, one that constitutes a figure of authority in the very act of speaking. And engages in a kind of revolt for which modernism has given us quite a detailed and complex genealogy in many languages and many geographic locations. It may be that ranting is a modernist trope or a modernist practice, but I see it around me a lot. I see it every day. And I think it's quite closely related to our modern conception of political speech and self-autonomy as being located in the ability to speak your piece, to speak your mind.
I associate ranting with a high level of intensity and emotion.
Yeah.
Is this required to be a
so.
Ranter?
I think so. Although one of my ranters is very quiet, Right. So not it needn't be associated with volume, for instance. But I think intensity, effective risk, being always at the edge of the acceptable criticism, the acceptable way of framing an argument, the possibility that you might get totally out of control, and abiding there at that edge, I think these are characteristic of the rant.
So you're associating this with modernism, though, and do you have specific texts in mind?
Yeah.
Such as?
Well, think of Baudelaire's diabolical poems. Think of his spleen. These are prose poems he wrote about life in Paris. As the old Paris was disappearing, buildings were being demolished and a new Paris was rising up, a bit like Vancouver. And his criticism of middle-class morality or immorality, fakery everywhere, he denounced the modern spirit. But at the same time, and in these very poems in which he's denouncing almost everything, he also was constructing himself as a project. And he was very aware that this was a new duty of the poet, and perhaps of everyone, if they didn't want to become social types. So with Baudelaire, we see the invocation of the diabolical as a way of developing images, sounds even, that resonate with this ranting persona.
But ranting certainly has a history which precedes the modern period. Would Jonathan Swift be considered or fall into the category of ranting?
I would think that satire has a very close relationship with ranting, in particular when the satirical takes off and kind of loses control. But I think the satires for which Swift is best known are examples of extreme self-control and may not be rants. There were, historically, there were ranters.
You mean as specific individuals, like in debate? We're going to bring in the ranter,
or
in Parliament. I mean, you, so-and-so, you know, my learned friend would be understood as the person who's going to rant about this particular piece of legislation or object to something.
I think that's quite likely, but I was referring to a group of antinomians in the 1630s, 1650s, who were bawdy, raucous, and did their spoken word events in public, in bars and brothels and so on. You're touching on a personality that of revolt, right? And, you know, people like Sartre, Bataille, Wilde have noticed that the spirit of revolt is something that seems to be native to the rise of cities, to urban life, to modernity as they saw it. And they often caution us against dissipating our energies in revolt. In fact, I would say that Wilde thought that he could exempt himself from such displays of undignified speech and emotion. But in my book, I look at his prison letter, De Profundis, as a rant, even though it was meant to be a very controlled self-vindication. It's a love letter written to his boyfriend. And but it is full of these really wonderful moments when the prose breaks down, when he really reveals himself. And I think that Wilde emerges as a more sympathetic character for everything he wrote in De Profundis.
So is it fair to say or ask, really, does ranting have a history?
Yeah. I think not. As I said, it's not a genre. I think it is a disposition, a habit of speech that really does emerge in modernity. It requires certain forms of anomie and subjection that we associate with the modern period. I think there may have been ranters in classical Greece, but they wouldn't necessarily have been of this type. There might have been the same similarities in tone and venom and fervor, but those aren't the qualities that really make for the rant. The rant has those characteristics, but it also has a very specific kind of address. And we haven't talked about this, but the book that is really framed around this idea of a politics of address. That addressing an audience, an authority figure, denouncing a tyrant, for instance, or a tyrannical law, is not a simple act, and is not really if we think of it as a theatrical setting, the blocking isn't clear. It can be extremely variable. I really do think that no two rants are identical in terms of form and style, but they do share the sensibility of address.
So Portnoy's Complaint by Philip Roth, 1969, is that a rant?
Hard to say. It is full of complaint. I look at Jane Bowles as an analogous figure, someone who had a writing block for 30 years after writing some really wonderful, what we call minor works. But in this writing block, she wrote every single day for 30 years. And these letters are long, they're torturous, they're full of complaint. They're also often highly stylish, incredibly witty. While she seems like she must have been an incredible handful and probably a very difficult person, her sense of humor, her wit, her liveliness, her love of life, all this comes through. Now, they are, in general, framed by exactly the politics of address I described. They are a kind of denunciation of an absent figure of authority, because often these are letters addressed to friends who don't stand in that position. But the tone of complaint, the dissatisfaction with the terms of her existence are very clear. And in this case, her rants are often surrounded by silence, by blockage. It's only in the letters that we see the verve and vigor of her, what Freud calls anti-cathexis, her inability to attach to things that comes out in this form of complaint.
Does theater encourage ranting?
Well,
Tennessee Williams,
yeah,
Pinter,
yeah.
Even though Pinter has so much silence,
right.
Even Arthur Miller, with some of his characters who become so excised over moral dilemma and choice and the attempt to do right, but it ends up wrong.
Yeah. Tennessee Williams is a very interesting reference here. I think that's true. One of my earliest inspirations for thinking about ranting actually came through film, a documentary and a feature film. The documentary was the Life and Times of Eileen Wuornos. This became the basis for the Hollywood film Monster. In a nutshell, Eileen Wuornos was a woman who committed a series of murders of Johns in the South. And she insisted on defending herself in court. And the documentary presentation of her speeches in the courtroom really seemed to me to be poignant, monstrous, cringeworthy, and yet so compelling, because here was someone who fully believed that she had the right to defend herself, to speak her piece in a court of law. And that for me became a paradigmatic of ranting. Another film that really moved me is Safe, which Julianne Moore stars in it. And she's a sort of stereotypical Southern Californian housewife whose life is nothing but emptiness. And she contracts a mysterious disease. You're never sure throughout the film if she's a classic hysteric or if she has an environmental disease. But there is a moment toward the end of the film where she's at a kind of a recovery or rehab for people with environmental disease. And it's her birthday. And they pass her the mic. She's given an opportunity to speak to people. Finally, she is the center of attention. And she delivers this crumbling speech in which she just falls apart, beaming all the while, thinking that she is actually finally committing a speech act that authenticates herself. And that, too, seemed to me to be characteristic of ranting. It's very low-key. There's no intensity of rage or anger, but there is an intensity of psychic crumbling that is quite moving. It's really a moment of genius in the film.
Well, I think your phrase, a speech act that authenticates oneself, is a wonderful way of encapsulating perhaps what the rant accomplishes.
Yeah.
What about courtrooms generally? I've always understood courtrooms as theatrical.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great deal of posturing that goes on. The function of the judge is actually to underreact and to listen and then to, you know, reserve judgment usually. Even if an oral judgment is to be made, the judge excuses herself or himself, comes back and then offers, you know, an interpretation akin to the law. Courtroom dramas seem to me to be spectacular. So in To Kill a Mockingbird, is there a rant? Does Gregory Peck go on a rant?
Yeah. Usually when this is performed in a Hollywood film, it's a moment of vindication. And I think that rhymes with our belief that such moments do actually redeem the self and redeem the figure of the speaking subject, something we hope for. I think it's an unconscious fantasy that we all have about the political and about community and perhaps about, you know, rectifying wrongs. The ramifications are multiple. I would say, though, in my own work, I looked at a different kind of courtroom. In my second book project, I've been thinking about women's testimonies in court, and in particular, testimonies by women at the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was decommissioned in 1998. So there were 2 years where the new South Africa was actually seeking women's voices and women testifiers and witnesses to, in particular, sexual, politically motivated sexual violence during the era of apartheid. This was actually inspired by a feminist critique of the TRC that had noticed that women were not coming forward except as mothers, sisters, aunts, relatives looking for their dead. And the TRC wanted to produce women as subjects, citizens of the new South Africa, which required women to come and speak about injury. Well, what happened in the women's commissions? Many, many women came forward and said, I am not ready to speak of this. I do not wish to speak of this. I will not be healed if I speak of it. And this refusal seemed to me very interesting and very much apart from that other fantasy of the speaking subject who redeems him or herself in public. This was a different kind of subjectivity and one that was perhaps indicative of a post-colonial difference. There were women who did come forward, who did speak about their traumas, but in at least one case, the ramifications of this were very unfortunate. When they went back to their neighborhoods, they were viewed as prostitutes, as having done something improper in public and before the nation. So the publicness of speaking one's piece is not universally accepted. It's critiqued in different ways in different contexts. And for me, that it's not exactly a courtroom, the Women's Commission, but it is official, great pomp and circumstance, opening the session, the kinds of theatricality and role-playing that you describe in a courtroom very much take place there.
And there are transcripts, presumably.
Absolutely.
Now,
and they're on the internet.
I see. Now, what about oral transcript? Can you actually hear the testimony? Can you hear the women's voices? And won't that have some role to play in terms of the, I'll say, authenticity, but I mean the emotional authenticity of the speaker, as opposed to reading the transcript? I mean, we read texts, but somehow voice does not always translate from the page into our perception.
It's an important point. No cameras were allowed in the women's commissions, and there are various forms of privacy that were created to make women feel more comfortable and be more able to produce the kind of speech act that the state wanted. The transcripts, though, are quite affecting. And they're available for anyone to read. And I think that this, the fact that they were being archived, that they were being recorded, was a kind of impediment for some women to speak. And yet it was also an incitement for women to come forward and say, no, I will not speak of it. You know, one of the most moving disclosures in this transcript is that of a journalist who herself had not suffered torture in prison, although she was in prison. But she spoke in the Women's Commissions of suffering from having overheard what was happening to others. So there, you can pick up the trace of the voice, of the sound that echoes for this individual in her memory and continues to trouble her present. There were recordings of other sessions, for instance, video recordings of perpetrators describing torture techniques. And these were broadcast on the national TV station and, to a completely riveted national audience. That function of public disclosure and, capturing the full reality of the testimony certainly did exist in the TRC.
Well, you've been covering so many fascinating topics in our conversation. I really do want to ask you, what would be your ideal course to teach?
I have taught that course, I think. When I was a graduate student, I taught a course for a lower division course called Women and Ranting. And the question was, do women rant? Because my working proposition at that time was that no, they don't. That this is a masculine form. Probably because I'd been reading a lot of Wyndham Lewis. And I thought maybe women complain but don't rant. Maybe men are the ranters. Perhaps you need that overweening masculinity, the bombast. I learned so much from the students at Berkeley in teaching that course, and they were so willing to read all kinds of things. Memoirs of Sacher Masoch. They read Venus in Furs. They read Deleuze and Guattari. And they were willing participants in an experiment to develop my own theory, and they proved me wrong. Indeed, there is female ranting, women's ranting. So that may have been the ideal course. I would like to teach more courses that explore these issues in relation to a wider field of literary and historical reference. And one of my research interests right now is to study the history of colonial psychiatry in North Africa and South Africa, which I've been doing, but to try to break out of those historical accounts to really think about what is the speech act of modernity in the post-colonial setting. I have a clue in the South African women who refused to testify, right, but who came to say that they would not say. In the Moroccan case, we have psychiatric and psychoanalytic and ethnographic material that suggests to us a really different idea of what it means to speak in community, in public, and more openness to, I think, to what I call the post-colonial phantasmagoria, i.e. reveries, dreams, sharing of material that isn't necessarily personal, because often people do not view their dreams as their own, right, their visitations, but to share in fantasy, basically.
Do you make a distinction, particularly when you begin to talk about the Truth and Reconciliation Committees and other somewhat institutionalized forms of speech, a distinction between what I would simplistically call a natural kind of speech, which would be very informal, perhaps more conversational, and a more formal, I am under oath, and there's a bureaucracy at play here, and that kind of speech? And does that affect the validity of description?
Yes, I think it does. In the case of Eileen Wuornos, who is someone who might be described as, certainly under mental duress and perhaps not a fully rational person. The staging of the courtroom, the fact that it was an official speech act, was very important to her, and it prompted different kinds of elements to emerge, different kinds of evidence to be brought forward. But really, she used it as a platform to defend herself, sort of globally, not merely to defend herself against the charges that were raised. In the case of the women's commissions at the TRC, I would say that different witnesses, different testifiers, were able to draw attention to the official trappings, the bureaucratic nature of the event in different ways. So there's an array of understanding of that and of indexing of its importance. In the case of Morocco, in the materials I'm looking at, what is interesting to me is something that came to light through the ethnography of a former mentor at Berkeley, Stefania Pandolfo. She interviewed psychiatrists working in psychiatric hospitals in Morocco, and it's really their concern over speech that is happening outside of the hospital, outside of the clinical setting, which they fear may enhance or elaborate symptoms rather than alleviate symptoms. And I should say that these are psychiatrists who, by and large, are trained in a Lacanian style of psychoanalysis, which is to say, an approach that really values listening and speech, and actually thinks of cure as a kind of culminating speech act that will happen in the therapeutic relationship, in the analytic enclosure. And so the fact that, or the possibility, I should say, that perhaps the curing and or therapeutic speech is happening outside becomes a problem for the physician who is himself contained by the institution. This is interesting because it could mean then that wild psychiatry or psychoanalysis outside of the institution would be kind of an interesting thing to study.
Absolutely, a sort of psychiatry on the street, which in some ways may be freer than within the hospital situation or even the physician's, therapy room, whatever we call it, gets me thinking about the classroom.
No. No, we don't do that.
And
I don't think
happens?
That would be legal either.
No, I wasn't even going there. Anyway, this has been a fabulous conversation, and I think you do succeed so well in bringing the world to the classroom in order to expand understanding of students. It's really marvelous. So thank you so much for joining us today. I want to again thank Dina Alkasim from the Department of English for being yet another one of our most intriguing guests here on UBC Arts on the Air, and invite everyone to join us for future profiles of the imaginative and indeed the stimulating members of the Faculty of Arts. Thank you, Dina.
Thank you, Ira.
Okay.
This week on the Arts Report, film, theater, dance, books, visual art, and more. Every Wednesday at 5 p.m., CITR Art Director Megan Thomas and the Arts Reporters explore what's fun, fascinating, campy, or critical in the Vancouver art scene. You can find bonus content on our Mixcloud, Facebook, and Twitter. Got an idea for a review, interview, or original production? Email arts@citr.ca. Listen Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or anytime on citr.ca.
$1 billion on the ground, all stretched out and uncurled, would extend about four times around the circumference of the world.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the West End at
Australian Boot Company, Banyan Books and Sound, Baru Latino Restaurante, The Bike Kitchen, Cove, Dentry's Pub, Displaced Hatchery, Limelight, The Eatery, Fresh is Best Salsa, Gargoyles, Prussian Music, Rufus's Guitar Shop, and the UBC Bookstore.
It pays